This is Jessica Yellen, host of the News Not Noise podcast, former White House correspondent for CNN and ABC. You can find the News Not Noise letter on bulletin.com. I am very excited to be your guest host for the next month. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of May, and wow, was there a bombshell out of D.C. A leaked draft opinion suggests the Supreme Court is poised to overturn the landmark 1973 decision that ensured the right to abortion. It's been met with either cold shock or elation, with activists and lawmakers reacting and preparing for what a post-Roe America might look like. Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel to discuss all that. I am your guest host and your center. I'm joined by Tim Kearney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
And on the left, Jill Filipovich, a journalist and lawyer who covers human rights and reproductive health. She's a CNN columnist who writes at jill.substack.com. Hi, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, let's underscore that this is a draft opinion from February. The court's ultimate ruling, which is expected within the next few weeks, could be quite different. But the fact that five justices did sign on to an opinion that found Roe was, quote, egregiously wrong from the start, tells us where this is headed. If the ultimate ruling is close to this, Tim, what's your view of the court's finding?
Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. And that's something agreed upon by lots of judicial scholars, even including pro-choice ones who would try to establish a right to abortion in some other way. It was upheld in Casey in 1992, but the pro-life movement has been working for 50 years to overturn it, and this would be an amazing victory. It'd be an amazing victory for the unborn, but also just for constitutional sort of honesty. Roe invented a right out of the penumbras and emanations of the Constitution. Now, that is a constitutional debate, and there are disagreements on it. Obviously, I'm expressing my view very strongly. There's a separate political debate and a separate moral debate. So one thing that we have to remember here is the Supreme Court is not going to declare every abortion in America to be illegal. The Supreme Court won't affect abortion law in New York or California at all with this ruling. The first question is, does the Constitution protect the right to an abortion? The answer is obviously no. Looking at Roe's shoddy reasoning made that clear. And if the court does actually rule the way this draft suggests, they are righting a generations-long wrong.
There's a lot to react to in there, but first, Jill, I want your view. If this is ultimately what the court rules, your take?
If this is ultimately what the court rules, it's devastating for women, for gender equality, and also for the public's trust and confidence in the Supreme Court. It simply isn't the case that legal scholars generally and overwhelmingly agree that Roe was wrongly decided. The Supreme Court itself has upheld not just Roe multiple times, but the other cases that are based on a right to privacy. That right is extended to the right of same-sex couples to get married, and it includes the right to use contraception. These are issues that the court has evaluated over and over and over again and consistently held that there is a constitutional right to privacy. Overturning Roe doesn't just do away with Roe, but it calls into question that fundamental privacy right. It's also terrible for women. One thing that we know everywhere in the world through the entirety of human history is that making abortion illegal does not end abortion. It simply makes abortion less safe. So if the court overturns Roe, it is not the case that abortion will end in states that have restrictive abortion laws. It is the case that abortion will be more stigmatized, it will be more dangerous, doctors will go to jail, and women will go to jail. And that's the universe that the court is opening up for us.
I'll say this. As a network news journalist, I've covered all sides of this debate. But because I'm now an independent journalist, and for transparency on the show, I want to be clear that personally, I support abortion rights, and you'll hear me express those opinions today. I'll also work hard to ensure Tim has ample space to express his opinions as well. My view, if this ruling becomes final, it will rupture this country in ways we haven't yet seen. There is nothing moderate about stripping away almost 50 years of protections women and pregnant people thought we had. 36 million people would immediately be at risk of losing access to abortion in their states. People will die. And a Washington Post ABC News poll taken last week shows only 28% of the country wants Roe overturned. The court's approval was at an historic low of 40% before the decision. It will be reviled by huge swaths of this country if this ruling comes down. Young women I speak to simply don't understand and can't accept that at least four men and one woman can decide their future against their will. Government only works because our social contract says we trust government to be just. This would shatter that belief for pro-choice Americans. If we were divided before, with this ruling, we will be in a social civil war.
To address the public opinion on it, polls that ask people what they think of Roe v. Wade are not, in fact, informative. The latest poll that came out just this week from YouGov and The Economist asked people, when do you think abortion should be legal and illegal? And so the views of the people on this panel represent a minority. Me, who thinks that abortion, basically except to save the life of a mother, should be illegal because it is the taking of an innocent human life, that's a small minority. The people who think that abortion should always be legal is also a small minority. Where you find 65% of the U.S. population, according to this latest Economist YouGov poll taken last week, is that after 15 weeks, abortion should be illegal except in grave circumstances. What is that? That's exactly the Mississippi law at stake here. I know this case has a broader ruling than that, but the question before the court about this Mississippi law has two-thirds support of the U.S. So to say that most people want to overturn Roe, that's because most people misunderstand and they think that overturning Roe would outlaw all abortion. Should we restrict abortion more than the Supreme Court currently allows? A vast majority of the people say yes. I don't think that public opinion settles this issue, but if we're going to talk about public opinion, that needs to be made clear.
But this decision does not simply uphold the Mississippi law. This decision overturns Roe versus Wade, if this were to stand. So, Jill, I want to give you a moment to put aside the politics and the law. I want to talk about the lived reality. 13 states have trigger laws on their books. More have restrictions set to kick in if this decision comes down. What would this ruling mean for women and other childbearing people in states across the country?
Well, I've seen what happens firsthand when abortion is illegal or highly constricted. I'm a reporter. Much of my work involves reporting on reproductive rights and human rights in countries where abortion is outlawed or very difficult to get. And I can tell you a little bit about some of the women that I've met. I mean, I met a woman named Silvana who was raped during Colombia's Civil War. She was a teenager. She didn't know where to get an abortion. Abortion was illegal in her country. She starved herself until she had a miscarriage. I met a girl quite recently, just a couple years ago in Honduras. I'm giving her the pseudonym Sophia, but she was 12 and about to give birth, because Honduras outlaws not just abortion, but also emergency contraception. These are the stakes. This is what will happen in the United States the second that Roe goes. Many of those states that have trigger laws don't have exceptions for rape, don't have exceptions for incest, only allow abortions if a woman's life is in danger or if a woman is in the throes of a massive medical emergency. It's unforgivable. It's impossible to overstate how much this will impact all of us, not just people who need abortions, but also women who are now living in a country where more than half of states will restrict our basic fundamental rights to make the choice about when and whether to become parents. It will impact women's ability to graduate from college, graduate from high school, enter the workforce, support ourselves. You know, I think you'll notice quite clearly that the anti-abortion movement, as much as they focus on making abortion illegal and often making abortion a felony, they don't focus nearly as much on making sure that children, that mothers, that families have what they need to survive and to thrive. They overwhelmingly oppose expanding the welfare state. They overwhelmingly oppose things like expanding contraception access, which we know decreases the abortion rate. So we're walking into an incredibly hostile, increasingly misogynist country and an anti-abortion movement that has made clear it is now going to push for a federal law outlawing abortion nationwide. This will not be an issue that is simply thrown to the states. Roe is not going to solve this national divide.
Well, it's an unfair characterization. It's a false characterization of the pro-life movement to say that we don't work to take care of women of who are pregnant, of their babies, etc. That if you look at, I mean, I end up a couple times a year at a pro-life dinner gala. If you look at how my wife and I do our charitable giving, it goes not to, you know, people who lobby to overturn Roe or lobby for stricter abortion laws, but to the crisis pregnancy centers, you know, the one right around the corner from our house, where almost every mother who shows up is a speaks only Spanish and is an immigrant and is in a poor situation. And we want to make sure that she has support so she isn't pushed to make the wrong decision, so that she isn't pushed to have an abortion. And nobody comes at it with judgment because of the horrific situations, as Jill was describing, that so many of these women end up in. And finding out you're pregnant after being raped, finding out you're pregnant when you're a single mom, especially in a new country, all of those things are absolutely crushing. And this is why we stand up these pro-life crisis pregnancy centers. But you just cannot ignore, if you're talking about compassion, you cannot ignore the other person in this equation. There's a woman I interviewed. I do reporting on this too, Jill. And a woman I interviewed, it was Christy Hofferber, and she knows about rape and incest because her mother was raped by her own father, who is Christy's grandfather, of course. Christy was one of five pregnancies that her mother had through this horrific situation. Four of them were aborted. And Christy is alive today because in that one situation, her mother was able to escape this monster of a man and was able to carry the child to term.
The reality, Tim, is that only, this is according to reporting from the Washington Post, only 5% of crisis pregnancy centers offer prenatal care. Virtually none of them offer contraception to women who are coming in already having unintended pregnancies. The pro-choice movement has said over and over again that one of our top priorities is supporting women who choose to carry pregnancies to term. And that's why we support a whole slew of government programs to support women, support families. What the anti-abortion movement has done is throw up a few crisis pregnancy centers that offer women some diapers, maybe a little bit of help in the first year, but do not support poor women and their children for the entirety of those children's lives, and frankly, don't support those women in preventing future unintended pregnancies. So I'm sorry, that it's flat out insufficient for what women need.
Yeah, I mean, the characterizations and the data, I mean, we're just used to it on the pro-life side because 95% of the news media is like you, Jessica, pro-choice. And the fact is that any time, and this is the way this debate goes, is that anytime we talk about, okay, here's where the dividing line is, the conversation gets dragged away from it, okay? Do pregnant women, especially unmarried, poor, immigrant, pregnant, Native American pregnant women need more support while they are pregnant and after they have the baby? Yes. Are there pro-life conservative Republican lawmakers who don't care about that? Absolutely, yes. I mean, Senator Ron Johnson says, yeah, we have no obligation to help other people take care of their babies. He's dead wrong, okay? I am a Christian. I know that Jesus said our second commandment after loving God is to love our neighbors, specifically to look after the least of these. And if any conservative calls himself pro-life doesn't extend his own charity and his own view of public policy to include women who are struggling through crisis pregnancies and babies, then they are not living up to their name. But that does not invalidate the point that it is the fundamental role of government to protect the vulnerable and the innocent from violence, and that includes children who are still in their mother's womb.
I'd like to respond because you also invoked my work as a journalist. We don't have universal free maternal care in this country. If that is a priority to the pro-life movement, they can make alliance with the pro-choice movement and pass laws to change that reality. I will tell you that as a journalist, I worked hard to cover all sides of this story, and I often, in legacy media, worked for men who frequently said they are, quote, conflicted about abortion and said it's a distasteful topic to the audience. And they chose not to really let us cover it outside of big breaking news events. I'd query if the media today were as fervently pro-choice and ideological on this as suggested, why are so many people in this country shocked that the court might eviscerate Roe? Political people have known that this ruling could be coming for years, frankly. I'd argue it hasn't gotten the kind of consistent drumbeat coverage in the media as other issues, and that's what's needed to help the public understand. We're going to have to pause here for a quick beat. I will be back with Tim Carney and Jill Filipovich to talk more about America post-Roe.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
I'm Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left, Jill Filipovich, who is a lawyer and journalist who writes at CNN.com, among other places. I want to ask you, Jill, you write that this was, quote, never just about abortion. You say it's about denying women control over their bodies and a, quote, return to traditional gender roles. That's not what abortion opponents say and maintain. So would you explain what you mean and what you believe motivates this movement?
Sure. So if the primary motivation of abortion opponents was to decrease the abortion rate, they would engage in what has been proven over and over and over again to be the most effective way to decrease the abortion rate, which is some combination of easy access to free, highly effective contraceptives, particularly long-acting contraceptives, things like the IUD. They would support the kind of comprehensive sexual health education that helps young people to avoid pregnancy. They would also support exactly what we've been talking about, efforts to support women who do choose to continue a pregnancy, and frankly, to make it easier for women who are poor or who are struggling to make the choice to continue a pregnancy that they want. The anti-abortion movement has focused on virtually none of that and frankly opposes much of it. Most of the large anti-abortion groups in the U.S. either oppose contraception or are completely silent on the contraception question. And they also really do kind of kick the ball when it comes to supporting women who choose to have children. Many of the most pro-life states in the United States also have among the highest maternal mortality rates in the United States, the highest rates of child poverty. So I think we can see a pretty clear connection that this isn't really about babies. It's not really about life. If it was, we would see a very different policy landscape on the pro-life right. What it's very clear that this is about is a view of the world that is according to a particular gender hierarchy, where men essentially dominate the public, the political, and the economic spheres, and women are in charge of the private. I mean, this is why you see these kind of baskets of issues all going together on the anti-abortion right. So things like opposition to many forms of contraception, opposition to abortion, opposition to LGBT rights. There's a whole framework of issues that that side of the aisle is quite hostile to. And much of it does really go back to this idea of what a man's role should be, what a woman's role should be, and what the role of the nuclear family should be in society, which the pro-life right thinks should be central.
All right, let's talk politics. We've talked about trigger laws and where abortion will still be legal, but what is going to happen on the political front going forward? Jill, Republicans are poised to take one or both houses of Congress in the midterms. What's your assessment? Will this energize swing women if this decision comes down? Will it energize them so much it'll put Republican victory in jeopardy? And Senator Manchin said that voters care more about inflation than about Roe versus Wade. Do you agree?
I think Senator Manchin on on this and many things is dead wrong. Women and any men who care about women are incensed by this. This is a huge encroachment on women's rights. It is going to have a tremendous impact on the future of gender equality. And so, yes, I think women will be absolutely incensed over this. I also think we need to be quite clear about the stakes here. If the Republican Party takes the midterms, and if we have a Republican president in 2 years, the anti-abortion movement has been quite clear that they plan to push Republicans to introduce legislation that would outlaw abortion nationwide. They are not planning on stopping at letting the states decide abortion laws. So this is not just about conservative states that will outlaw abortion immediately if Roe goes. This is about the future of abortion rights for every single person in the United States. And the Democratic Party really needs to get on doing something about it to show their voters that they are going to act when they're needed.
Tim, going back to the state-by-state polling analysis I mentioned earlier, in the 13 states that have trigger laws on their books, the Times found that a majority in those states, 52%, said abortion should be illegal in most or all cases. So this is really a patchwork reality. For GOP candidates running in those states, do you think those Republican candidates should make passing a national ban on abortion a centerpiece of the campaign?
I think that a national ban on abortion would require more consensus on the issue than we have right now. And the one reason we don't have anything close to consensus on the issue is precisely because what Roe v. Wade did was take an issue that is ultimately political. That is about how are we going to balance the right of the unborn baby and the right of the mother whose life is being upended by this pregnancy. How are we going to balance them? Balancing those two things is not prescribed in the Constitution. It is left up to the politics. And one of the things that increasingly I've learned as I've watched how Congress works or doesn't work, as I've been, you know, on boards of directors, as I've seen how organizations work, is that if people have a chance to debate and fight and vote, even if they end up losing, they accept the result more. The fact that the pro-life side has not had a chance to fight, that it has been precluded by this rule, by this ruling from, you know, the Roe v. Wade, which has an immense amount of criticism from judicial scholars, that it sort of seemed to come out of nowhere and seemed to be entirely motivated by the result, has meant that we haven't had the chance to fight that catharsis. I think that the ugliness now, aided by what we spoke about last week, which was social media, but just because the emotions on this are so high, I think if it does end up having state-by-state debates, votes, amendments, and that sort of thing, that will come along to something more of a social peace if we have a debate. It's not going to be where Jill stands. It's not going to be where I stand. It's going to be somewhere in the middle where abortion is probably legal in the early stages and illegal except to save the life of the mother in later stages, and where the line is will be drawn by the democratic process.
Jill, in his opinion, Justice Alito argued that women could vote in a national law protecting the right to abortion. So what does it tell us that the pro-choice majority in this country has not been able to get a nationwide abortion protection through Congress?
It tells us that Congress is broken, and it tells us that the Republican Party has been systematically undermining American democratic norms for the past several years. I mean, if we're talking about what is good for democracy, the Republican Party is not it. The Republican Party has made very clear that it intends to essentially rig the game to secure its own power. When you look globally at what is happening with abortion rights, overwhelmingly abortion rights are being expanded. And expansions of reproductive rights go hand in hand with countries moving closer and closer toward liberal representative democracy. In the handful of countries where reproductive rights are being scaled back, the U.S. among them, what we also see are moves away from democratic traditions, moves toward autocracy. These are countries like Poland, like Hungary, like China, like Russia, like Brazil, and in the U.S. I mean, that's the group. Women's rights and democracy go hand in hand. And so when you see moves like we're seeing in the U.S. to undermine women's rights, it's not a coincidence that that's also happening right at the same time as you have a former president who's calling into question a free and fair election, while you have attacks on voting rights. These are all interconnected. And the reality is that fundamental rights should not be up for a vote. And so the idea that we should simply toss this to the voting public is frankly insulting. And the way that our system works is that the Supreme Court is supposed to be a bulwark for fundamental constitutional rights. And here they are setting themselves up to fail.
So, I mean, France, yes, did just expand its liberalize its abortion laws from 12 weeks to 14 weeks. If France adopted Mississippi's law, the one that we're presumably talking about here, it would be further liberalizing its laws. Mississippi is more liberal on abortion than France. You say pro-lifers, really, they don't care about abortion. What you're continually doing is moving away from the two issues at hand. The first is Mississippi's abortion law, which is more liberal than France's. Should it be tolerated? And again, public opinion polling says yes. I think the conscience of most Americans is early abortion is acceptable, later abortion is not. So that's the first question. Mississippi saying abortion is legal up till 15 weeks and afterwards if it's needed in grave circumstances for the life of the mother. The second issue at hand is, does the Constitution include a right to abortion? It doesn't include every possible liberty. There's a big fight about this in the courts, 90 years ago when Franklin Roosevelt was a president, and there was the Lochner Doctrine, which was sort of that there's a broad idea of liberty and the government can't intrude on your liberty, and that was thrown out the window. But it's basically that same exact reasoning that was behind Roe, which was to say, well, no, this liberty was not in any way enumerated, and yet we're going to put it here. And why is that abortion? The other things you refer to that you and I both want, we want to make sure that all mothers have good health care, that everybody has good health care. Is there no constitutional right to that? The idea of a constitutional right to abortion is what the question is here, not what Jill thinks about pro-lifers and not what Jill thinks about the Republican Party. But the questions are Mississippi's abortion law and does the Constitution have an enshrined right to abortion?
I mean, I'm actually curious from you. Okay, if you believe that abortion rights are not covered under the Constitution because this right to privacy was invented, do you believe that the court should also uphold or strike down the right to contraception, the right to same-sex marriage, and the right to interracial marriage?
So Loving v. Virginia, the establishing that states cannot prevent interracial marriage, didn't have the same groundings as Roe v. Wade at all. It was based on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And the gay marriage decision was in part based on the Equal Protection Clause. The idea of a right to privacy grounded in substantive due process, which is sort of an interpretation of the 14th Amendment, that's what they had to dig into the penumbras and the emanations. And so if you're going to talk about birth control here, what we're going to talk about is the political process. There is not a single state, not a single city, and I don't think there's a single county or town that would outlaw contraception. The fact that it's sort of widely held that this should be totally legal doesn't mean it's enshrined in the Constitution. Our political process works. There's all sorts of things that we all agree on that are not protected by the Constitution, but are instead the political process and local and state laws or federal laws are what guarantee our access to it.
Jill, let's pick up on that. In some states, there are already efforts to limit access to medication abortion. If the court overturns Roe or even falls short but upholds the Mississippi law, do you believe there will be a political push to ban or restrict access to contraception and medication abortion?
I think it's very clear that contraception and even things like in vitro fertilization are potentially at risk when Roe is overturned for exactly the reason that Tim just said, that it's not just Roe. It's this whole line of cases, which includes Griswold v. Connecticut and the related cases that expanded contraception access for Americans. The anti-abortion movement, many strains of it, not every single pro-life person, but many of the leading folks who are writing the model laws that states are implementing, are writing them in such a way that would potentially challenge contraception access, particularly the most effective forms of contraception, like the IUD, like the birth control pill. Many anti-abortion groups argue that the pill, the IUD, things like emergency contraception are essentially abortifacients, that these are things that interrupt the implantation of a fertilized egg from landing in the uterus. There's quite a bit of debate over whether or not that's true. But the Supreme Court has already held in a separate case that it doesn't really matter if that's true or not for that to be considered a sincerely held religious belief. It's very clear to me that attacks on contraception are coming.
Jill, let me follow up on that briefly, because this week for the News Not Noise podcast, I interviewed the head of Planned Parenthood LA. They are preparing to become abortion sanctuary clinics. So people who live in states that conceivably won't have abortion can travel to California to get the procedure in California. Do you fear or believe there will be laws criminalizing that act and limiting women's ability to access abortion in other states?
Yes. The anti-abortion movement is absolutely going to try to prevent women and girls from going across state lines to access reproductive health. They are already working on limiting access to medication abortion, and they will limit access to contraception. This is all in the playbook. It's all coming.
Tim, I want to get your opinion on this. At least one Republican lawmaker has introduced a measure to criminalize women who travel to other states to get abortions. Do you support measures like that to criminalize people who either self-induce or travel?
The idea of stopping somebody's free motion across state lines is not something I would get behind. But, I mean, I also just think to steer away from the issue at hand into the extreme cases, I think it's not productive. I think we should talk about what the issues are at hand, or I could drag up my own extreme cases. Like if somebody tries to make it impossible to save a woman who has an ectopic pregnancy, I will appear on stage with you, Jill, and oppose that effort. I'll co-byline an op-ed for CNN.com saying, you know, a woman has to be able to treat this to save her life for this, in the case of this ectopic pregnancy. There's all sorts of places that we agree, and it just seems that the effort to move away from 15 weeks after that point, should a woman be allowed to abort her child, and does the Constitution guarantee a right to an abortion? In my mind, what that does is that shows that there's a scare campaign by the pro-choice side because they do not want to talk specifically about this issue, precisely because most Americans, two-thirds, agree that after the first trimester, or at least after 15 weeks, that at that point, a woman does not have a right to abort her child. She should carry that baby to term because that is a living human being who has the right to life.
Tim, can I ask you to just clarify your position in this? Because what you're talking about defending is the Mississippi law. And you're arguing that anything that imagines an abortion ban is extreme. But the decision penned by Alito would allow for abortion bans in some states, outright bans, and some states are poised to execute on those bans almost immediately. So is it your view that the court should uphold Mississippi, but not the Alito position?
No. So that's probably the John Roberts position. My own personal view is that Roe v. Wade is obviously wrong. And I live in the state of Maryland now, and I know what Maryland would do. Maryland is already expanding access to abortion. It's very liberalized in the ability to get it. It's subsidized, and insurance companies will be required to cover it. And there are Democratic politicians on all levels who want to strip away a doctor's conscience freedom to not participate.
Do you think the Alito position is extreme?
No, the Alito position is not about whether abortion should be illegal. It's does the Constitution protect abortion? And, I mean, it's not extreme because, I mean, one of the most curious things about Roe is that behind its own verbal smokescreen, writes Lawrence Tribe, the substantive judgment on which it rests is nowhere to be found. Here's a Ruth Bader Ginsburg quote. Roe, I believe, would have been more acceptable as a judicial decision if it had not gone beyond ruling on the extreme statute before the court. It was heavy-handed judicial intervention that is difficult to justify. And I mean, I could go on and on with all sorts of pro-choice legal scholars. Benjamin Witte saying Roe is a lousy opinion that disenfranchised millions of conservatives. I mean, we could go on and on. The view that Roe was wrongly decided is in no way extreme. The next step, the state policies that get passed, that's not a question that Alito gets to answer. That's not a question that Sonia Sotomayor gets to answer.
I've been talking with Jill Filipovich and Tim Carney. We'll be back with other laws relating to the right to privacy. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left is our special guest, lawyer and journalist, Jill Filipovich. So let's get back to both the politics and the law here. Tim, conservative New York Times columnist Bret Stephens wrote a piece saying in part that overturning Roe is not conservative, that doing so would, quote, betray the trust of Americans on an issue that affects so many so personally and would cause them to lose trust on every other issue as well. He called on the justices to be prudent. To me, that sounded like a message aimed squarely at Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Your take?
A Brett to Brett missive, so to speak. Yeah. So, I mean, the Brett Stevens argument there is probably the John Roberts view, which is that John Roberts basically wants the court to disrupt American life as little as possible. And that's a type of small C conservatism. And that's what Brett is arguing there. And I acknowledge that. But this is why the term egregiously wrong is so important. Conservatism cannot mean preserving whatever we currently have, no matter how egregiously wrong it is. Segregation was the status quo, and getting rid of that was massively disruptive. Slavery was the status quo, and getting rid of that was massively disruptive. And so it's an argument that deserves some weight, but in this case, it's ultimately outweighed, A, by the central substantive issue on abortion, which is that it's always wrong to deliberately take an innocent human life. But B, on the political grounds, as all sorts of, much smarter than me, legal scholars and political analysts have said, taking abortion out of the democratic process did not settle it. It prevented the sort of debate and negotiation and all of that that allows an issue to eventually be settled.
Jill, Senator Collins said that this decision, if the Alito decision is issued, would be inconsistent with what Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch said in their hearings and in private meetings with her. They told her, she said, Roe is precedent and they won't overturn precedent. Murkowski said her confidence in the court has been rocked. So what's the point of the confirmation process if Supreme Court nominees can now basically lie about their judicial views?
It is not surprising to pro-choice folks who were saying this whole time, Brett Kavanaugh is lying, Neil Gorsuch is lying when they say they will uphold Roe. We certainly knew that, but it's egregious, it's offensive that these men would stand up in front of the Senate, in front of their country, and say that they plan to uphold Supreme Court precedent when we know now they never had really any intention of doing that. And it's frankly quite dangerous. We are nationally at a pretty precarious tipping point. We are highly polarized. There have been huge encroachments on American democratic traditions. Americans have lost faith in so many of our most valued institutions, including the Supreme Court. And this really is a moment where I fear that if the court overturns Roe, not only is that terrible for women and people who care about women, but it's really terrible for American institutions and for people's trust in this country and, frankly, in our ability to remain a cohesive whole.
I mean, I'd want an exact quote of when these justices as nominees said they would uphold Roe. I agree that they were mealy-mouthed, and I wish that they had said Roe was egregiously wrong. and I wish they'd said that in their confirmation hearings. And I can't explain why Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski thought they were saying they were upholding Roe, because they explicitly said Roe is a precedent, and every precedent deserves weight. And I don't remember a single quote of them explicitly saying they would uphold the decision.
Well, didn't Kavanaugh say it's precedent on precedent and he respects stare decisis and precedent?
I mean, he was dodging the question because he knows that for some reason, the one issue that you're allowed to ask a nominee, how are you going to rule on, is abortion. And so every conservative nominee has dodged the question. I would have preferred if he had said, it's a precedent. Precedents deserve weight. Some precedents are bad. And thank God we've overturned some of the worst ones in this country.
Jill, stare decisis isn't just an abstract legal principle. Isn't it also about maintaining trust with the public and allowing people to predict the future and plan their lives? What are your views on trust in the court if super precedent is overturned here?
Right. I mean, trust in the court has already been waning. It's increasingly seen as a political institution. No, it certainly doesn't help that four or five Supreme Court justices were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. And yet managed to put their guys and one woman on the court. We are at such a precarious political and social moment in the U.S. We are not more polarized than ever. I mean, arguably, we were more polarized during the Civil War. But this is a moment where I think folks on both sides are quite nervous about, you know, the level of mutual animosity, but also kind of how, frankly, far off the rails so many folks on the right have gone in terms of just total divorce from reality. And I do worry that if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, not only does it re-feed into that sense of, you know, the court is political, the court is kind of just another branch of Congress, but it will really cleave open the American public rather than, you know, Tim's ideal of this kind of great open debate and every state can do it at once. I actually think we're going to have a massive rupture. It's going to be tons of court cases, tons of legislation, huge battles, pitched battles. And I'm not sure that this helps us walk back from the precipice that we're currently on. I frankly think it, you know, it may be the final thing that pushes us off of it.
I mean, an interesting thing here is when it's not a far right position to say that states should be allowed to regulate abortion, because what Roe v. Wade says is only in after, you know, viability are states allowed to regulate abortion. At the Examiner, we did a poll a couple years ago, and among independents, it was 47 to 36 saying, yes, individual states should be free to regulate abortion as they see fit. That is, in effect, 47 to 36 plurality with 17% undecided saying Roe is illegitimately preventing states from being able to do what they want to do. And then again, 2/3 of Americans believe that after 15 weeks, abortion should be illegal except to save the life of the mother. So this isn't anybody walking off of any edge. It's a Supreme Court ruling that is not grounded in the Constitution and that is at odds with what most of the public believes. I think that it's not going to be peaceful. I hope I didn't imply that I thought this was going to be a nice collegiate debate like you might have about setting tax rates or something like that. This is going to be unpleasant. And because such emotional things are involved, and because it does have to do with experiences that half of this country can have and another half doesn't, and that is always life-changing, whether it's a joyous pregnancy or a terrifying pregnancy, but also because it has to do with the life of a tiny little baby who is innocent and has done nothing wrong. And so, yes, the emotions are going to be high. Yes, it's going to be ugly. But keeping it out of the public square has not created social peace for the last 50 years. It's not created the sort of reliance, to use the legal term, that something like interracial marriage, people rely on that. This has created instead constant back and forth, constant uncertainty. And so that's why it, in fact, should carry less weight than other precedents.
Jill, I'm seeing on social media people sharing messages that women should start stocking up on medication abortion now, that women and people who can get pregnant should delete pregnancy tracking apps in case this decision does come down. What do you think the administration or politicians or pro-choice people can and should be doing now to prepare for the possibility that this decision does come down in the next few weeks?
Well, I think we certainly need more from the Democratic Party right now. The conversation about expanding the Supreme Court should be front and center. It should be something Democratic politicians are leading with. When it comes to what we can do individually, I think it's very important to understand that activists have been preparing for this moment for a long time. and that the U.S. is not the first country that has faced abortion restrictions. And so if you are interested in getting involved, you're not going to be reinventing the wheel. Figure out who in your community is running an abortion fund. That's a great way to tap in to an activist network. Figure out what you can offer, whether that's money, whether that's volunteer hours, whether that's some professional expertise. And yes, figure out how medication abortion works, where to get abortion-inducing medications, and how to safely take them. AidAccess.org is one group that puts all of this information on their website. Medication abortion is overwhelmingly safe. And as of now, those medications are still accessible in the U.S. And so that's really important information to arm yourself with. I would also say keep talking about abortion and talk about the ways in which abortion has made so many people's lives, women's lives in particular, possible. Thinking through all of the women who wouldn't be where they are, wouldn't have the kids that they have, wouldn't be married to the person they're married to, wouldn't have fallen in love, wouldn't have gotten that job, wouldn't have traveled, wouldn't have run for office, wouldn't have written their novel or made their art if they hadn't been able to plan when and whether to become a parent.
Tim, do you want to have a last word here?
I think of women like Chrissy Hofberger and Jenny Moss, who would not have existed had their parents done what was, you know, followed an understandable instinct to get an abortion after suffering sexual violence and getting pregnant through it. But I'll just say this: whatever the law is, whatever the Supreme Court ruling is, if you have an unwanted pregnancy, what you need is compassion and love. And I would just say, please, 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 with your choice that you have now, choose life.
Well, I will agree. We all want to bring compassion and love to the conversation in some way. And I'm glad we've had a respectful discussion here. We're going to have to leave that part of the conversation here. We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, what's your rant?
We recently got a new study showing what we've known for the last couple of years, that closing schools really harmed kids' learning. This one in particular showed how the schools that closed for only 3 months compared to the schools that also closed in the 2020-2021 school year. The learning loss in those schools that had less closures was 20% compared to a normal year. In the ones that had more closures, it was 50%. We all know the emotional harm on children and their parents of staying home, of not having access to school. And it's not been shown that children were protected from getting infected with COVID by staying home, because guess what? Closing the schools and going remote didn't mean the children spent their whole time in their basement studying their Latin and their math. So I want an accounting. I want people to explain why they made the mistakes that they made. And I want us to promise that never again will we sacrifice our children for our own sense of security and safety.
Jill Filipovich, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind today is refugees and the failure of the Biden administration, compassionate conservatives, and even many progressive folks to really fully undo Trump's attacks on refugee resettlement and help to people in need. The Biden administration has raised the refugee cap, but it's not nearly sufficient. We have an ongoing refugee crisis in Afghanistan. We have a refugee crisis in Ukraine. And we have the 1 million refugees who were without safe harbor before either of those crises began. The U.S. is a nation of immigrants. It is a nation of people who are generous. We are tremendously lucky to live in a place that is stable, that is wealthy, and that is safe. We have the room and we have the resources. We should be opening our doors to many, many more refugees and creating a speedier path for them to be able to stay here forever and have permanent immigration status. And the Biden administration should really be taking the lead in making sure that huge numbers of refugees can enter our country, that they are supported, and that the kind of attacks on refugees that we saw under the Trump administration never happen again.
My rant is about the diplomatic dust-up brewing over Biden's attendance at the G20 summit. At issue, last week, Russia confirmed Vladimir Putin plans to attend. Indonesia, the host country, quickly extended an invitation to Ukraine's President Zelensky. He hasn't accepted. Biden has said Russia should be removed from the G20, and the question is now, should Biden go? The White House says they haven't made that decision. The media is framing the summit as a potential showdown between Biden and Putin, and CNN opines that boycotting the event would, quote, cede the table to Russia and China. Please, this one is simple. The president of the United States should not be in the same room as a man he is credibly accused of genocide unless and until they are negotiating a peace. Instead, the U.S. should coordinate with other G7 leaders and any other interested G20 countries to boycott the event. The G20 will survive it. Putin will be diminished for it. This is not just about standing on principle. It's strategy and negotiating posture and a message that with Putin in charge, Russia is a pariah state. The G20 is in 6 months. They have time to make a plan. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Tim Carney and Jill Filipovich. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine-Million. Our production assistant is Nisha Venkat. The show was recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jessica Yellen. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.